meeting to order. With us today is Representative Moses, Representative Holm, Representative Kelly, Co-Chairman Schnolk, myself, Co-Chairman Meyer, Vice Chairman Stoltz, Representative Jewell, Representative Hawker, and Representative Wyrick. Okay, today we are going to take up House Bill 375 first. That's retirement benefit liability. Then Senate Bill 250, domestic violence. And then Senate Bill 237. And let's see, I think it's House Bill 306, the Mat-Su, the conveyance of Hatcher Pass to Mat-Su, we will not take up today.
At the request
of the borough. Also, I know Representative Kutula, who is sick today, had wanted to participate. So hopefully we can get to that one tomorrow. So if you're here for Hatcher Pass, that will be tomorrow. So we will, let's go right on into House Bill 375. And what happened? Representative Wyrick. Okay. Representative Wyrick, you ready?
Where do you go?
Okay. What? Who wants to?
I'll stand. I can bring him with me.
Yeah, come on up.
I think Representative Wyrick had to be walked
in. An amendment.
Yeah, he had an amendment and wanted to make some changes.
If you want, we could just come back to his bill. Because I don't know.
Amendment,
go ahead.
If you'd like,
Mr. Have the amendment?
On behalf of the representative, I'd be happy to move his amendment.
Okay. Moved and objected to. All right. I'm looking. Okay, here it is. Amendment 2, is it? Okay. All right, go ahead.
All right, for the record, my name is Jacqueline Chacot, and I'm staff representative Bruce Wyrick. And, you know, as we looked at some of the solutions, I think overall, you know, the most important thing is that if we want to get this paid down, the sooner we start, the less our payments will be, and we can spread it over a longer period of time. So just as a policy, that's what we want to do. And we just wanted to get going. So I think the initial version of the bill was perhaps a little rough because we really felt that the expediency was the key component to really doing this. But as we looked at some of the communities, particularly Fairbanks, who had such a disproportionate ratio of past employees versus the current 95, and I think the past number, I have that in front of me here. Their past number was 279 plus another 108. And then their current employees, the active employees that were paying in, is 95. So they had this huge disparity, and we were concerned that they would also be treated fairly under this legislation. And so before you have Amendment 2, and I'll let Mr. Bader to my left explain the logistics of the calculations, but just as a policy, you know, I think this committee too needs to decide if we want to adopt this amendment as sort of a blanket amendment for all communities, and it talks about what the formula will be for them for previous to the FY 3 years ago. If we want to do a blanket, or if we want to specifically address Fairbanks because their numbers were way off the chart disproportionate to everyone else. I think that's sort of a policy call for this committee, whether or not you'd want to do this amendment or some other language. And I'll let Mr. Bader here explain.
Okay, before we go there, Representative Holm, did you have somebody from Fairbanks that you wanted?
I believe so. I believe.
Was it on this issue that they
yes,
wanted
it is.
To address? Okay. Why don't we go ahead and hear from them if they are still online? Was that Pat Cole? Is that the? Do we have Pat Cole, City Manager, Fairbanks, online, or Jeff Johnson?
Jeff Johnson.
Jeff Johnson. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and go to Jeff? I know public testimony's been closed, but at the request of Representative Holm, we'll hear from Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. The issue with the City of Fairbanks is that at June 30th, 2001, our net past unfunded liability was approximately $11.3 million. And at June 30th, 2004, it's bumped up to $95 million. But we have roughly an $80 million swing. We do not have the number as of June 30th, 2005. We think that's another $15 million. But in that period of time, our employment has been relatively stable from 80 to 95 of police and fire officers. Prior to that, the city, almost similar to what the Tier 4 does, did eliminate a lot of people in the plan by selling MUS. That cut out a couple hundred people. The city of Fairbanks employment declined about 200 people from some of the peak area. And so we've seen a decline in the number of employees that participate in PERS, and so thus take a look at the current House bill, see how the calculations are working on page, I believe it's page 12. On page 12, the example, the way the math works in this bill, it's supportive of large employers, not folks with past service costs, and obviously we have the past service costs. So you know, we're concerned about a portion of dollars that would come to the state because it's calculated on your current employment. For instance, if the city of Fairbanks said, you know, we think this PERS thing is so unpredictable, we'd like to transfer our police and fire to some other program, this formula would give us zero. And so trying to solve the problem at the city level by, say, getting out of PERS, we would receive subsidy per se from the state. And from that standpoint, kind of looking back to where the system was going back to 01, that $11 million sits out there, and the balance is as of June 30th, 2001. I know this is a wild thought, but if the city of Fairbanks was responsible for that dollar amount and had to pay that back over the next 25 years or the next 15 years to get this thing solved, and every other municipality in the same boat, the excess of the June 30th actuarial valuation for all the participating employers, if that was transferred to a separate account, which was funded from general state revenue sources, that would clear the air simply for everybody. Basically, you have to pay back where you were at June 30th, 2001, and the excess calculations that we've come to understand over the last 3 years that really reflect some of these benefits would be absorbed by the state of Alaska. And that's just a thought there, and I know it's kind of wild from what's proposed here, but any other questions, or are there any I could entertain?
Questions? Representative Kelly?
I think Jeff, Mike Kelly, we've talked about this quite a bit, but you, when the utility was sold, and I happened to be on the other side of the table in that during that sale, and at that time Pat Cole brought up the point, and it was a major point, questioning what the impact would be on the system of the sale, and the information that was received and upon which the city relied was that we would not have this sort of a train wreck at the end. Is that your understanding as well?
That's correct. And case in point, had the Vision Retirement closed out MUS, which was treated as a separate account at the time of the sale, we would have dodged all this realization that the numbers had been miscalculated for 20 years. And not that that's fair, but that would have been the reality. That may have benefited the Seward Hospital as well as the municipality of Anchorage. Although we sold our utility first, somehow the municipality of Anchorage was able to get closed out prior to the city of Fairbanks. So, and again, if you close out and withdraw from the system, in theory, you write your last check and you're done. Now, we know that had that have happened back in, say, 2000, calculations were horribly wrong because the actuaries, the assumptions were all bad. And the plan would have had to pick up the shortfall as a result of the city of Fairbanks' prior utility sale. But at June 30th, 01, that information, I believe, the net amount the city owed was about $11 million. And I believe that at that point in time, that was about $20 million for the city and a plus balance of $10 million for the municipal or for the utility company, netting to about $11,300,000. So, the city was cognizant that was the numbers we were working with. And, because of other policies, we were in the whole $11 million. I mean, I think that's reasonable for us to have to pay that $11 million back, just as everyone else's calculations at June 30th, 01, were thought to be correct back at that point in time. So this growth in this liability, again, which we all know is tremendous from that point forward, if that was assumed by the state and paid back over 25 years, you know, you really end up with a different House Bill 375, but you certainly have a simpler overview on the whole shooting match. But
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Representative Barrick, do you want to...
Mr. Chairman, it depends a lot on the administration of how this is going to work with the executive branch, and so I've really tried to figure ground truth this with the administration of how they can deal with this language, and it's workable.
Okay, if there's no more questions for Mr. Johnson, let's go ahead and go to Mr. Bader. Go ahead, Mr. Bader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in terms of a little background in terms of what's in front of you, as committee members are probably aware that each year the gains or losses of the retirement plan are calculated, and depending upon whether or not there's an actuarial gain or loss, that loss in this case is amortized over 25 years. The whole system experienced losses since the year 2000, first because of changes in health care assumptions that were and experience of the plan, secondly because of investment returns, thirdly many of the assumptions were changed in terms of looking forward and estimating the cost of what would be required to pay benefits down the road. All PERS employers were caught in this and these changes. And for example, PERS funding ratio declined from 95% to 68%, and the TERS funding ratio went from 101 to 75%. In addition to that, if that weren't bad enough, and as it relates to the city of Fairbanks, Fairbanks had additional impacts, and their impacts were that they made changes based upon information that they believed to be reliable and reduced the number of their PERS employees. Accordingly, when a payroll assessment is made against a reduced number of employees, that rate escalates to the point where I believe Fairbanks is somewhere up around the area of 125% of past service rate. The ARM board proposed to this committee, and it's embedded in this legislation, that the teacher system receive 85% of the past service cost rate. It used a different approach in terms of explaining how the committee might allocate funds to repay employers under PERS. And it was a somewhat complicated formula, but basically said no community would get more than the average of all PERS employers taken together. There is another approach that is in the amendment before you, and that approach is to be very similar to what was done with TERS. As I explained to the committee the other day, the ARM board had several goals. First of all, that the systems be fully funded within 30 years. Secondly, that it not cause severe disruption to public services. Thirdly, that the state should participate in the solution, and that accelerated contributions from employers should be rewarded, and that the state support should be equitable. And lastly, that it should minimize the impact or should not attempt to subsidize federally funded positions. And I think that the amendment before you is consistent with all of those goals. And so as I come here to speak for the ARM board's position on this, I think that the amendment in front of you is consistent with that. Essentially what it would do is take out the calculation based on past service rate, less 5%, or the average past service rate, whichever is less, and substitute in its place 85% of a community's past service rate. This, if 85% number is used, and that's a policy call for people such as yourself to make, but if 85% was used, it would have an additional cost to the system. But I think in terms of treating all employers equitably, which is a goal of the ARM board, and I'm sure the goal, a goal of this committee, that it is consistent with that desire. And in this instance, while we don't have actual numbers for 2005, as the previous speaker said, I think it is safe to estimate that compensation or the distribution to Fairbanks under this approach would be somewhere probably close to $5 million more than the $1 million that would currently be available under the bill before this proposed amendment. So with that, I would entertain any questions.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that, Mr. Bader. Yeah, frankly, I don't know if 85% is the right number or not. I'm looking for some guidance from somebody who might know more about this than me. Representative Kelly?
Yeah, and I wasn't offering guidance. I appreciate what Representative Wyrock's trying to do here, both in the main bill and in the amendment. I'd like just a little bit of time, Mr. Chair, to look at this and find out from get a reaction from the Fairbanks folks and have a chance to study this amendment a little bit more, if that's possible, and not objectionable to the sponsor.
I think Representative Kelly, I think that's where I'm at too. I want to support this. I want to get behind this, but I'm just not totally comfortable with it yet.
Let's noodle on it some more. I think we.
If you need to get back to your folks and need some more information, I think this.
People do have to be comfortable with this. This is a structural policy thing.
Yeah.
President Hawker, you have any thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, I concur completely with the discussion here, and I was prepared on the amendment. I'm prepared to vote yes on the amendment strictly at the request of the sponsor. It's the sponsor's bill. He'd like to see this taken up. I'm not sure. I honestly don't know if the amendment makes it a bill that I would be more or less inclined to support. But if you'll let me just the latitude of a reference on the bill. I mean, what we're doing here with this bill, and we make no mistakes about it, is important, and it's probably an absolutely critical step we're going to have to take, because we do have this $7 billion unfunded liability. We as a legislature are going to have to fund that liability one way or another. This would certainly be a potential vehicle, and it's all about how do we fund that liability. Mm-hmm. And as the specific issue from Fairbanks identified, there are so many unidentified complications, unresolved complications in writing this bill. Representative Jewell has, you know, similar complications with other municipalities that have very unique other characteristics in their funding status on their plans. Absolutely committed. We have to resolve the problem. We have to step up with some funding and a mechanism. I just don't know that we've got time in the last, less than 2 weeks of session now to get something fleshed out as complicated as this is going to be. Because make no bones about it, this bill has the potential of being the conduit through which we funnel $7 billion. That's not a decision I'm going to make lightly.
The other thing, Mr. Chairman, like most works in progress, this is a dynamic. You try and solve a huge problem statewide with a single policy call. I don't have any pretensions that this is a silver bullet that may not need work further down the line, either this session or every session to come. So my ego is not wrapped in this. This is simply a way to try and deal with the problem. And as this thing moves along, if we find ways that need to be tinkered with and dealt with substantively to address all the varied situations we have this day, I'm open to it. So, again, however you want to manage the bill is fine. I think that at some point the empirical analysis has to end, leaving with the caveat that we may have to revisit this once we see it in play and how it works, and come back with amendments. And I think everybody's going to be open to that, given the magnitude of the issue. So, at some point, you have to trust that the bill is going to do something, and when we learn that it doesn't do it, we're going to have to fix it. And also, it doesn't require us to have a huge appropriation this year. It's putting the policies in place, which is important. So it wouldn't be like we're spending bad money or good money after a bad policy either. So there's that stopgap.
That's true, and I would agree. I'm prepared to vote yes on the amendment, but I think that if the representatives from Fairbanks want time to go back and talk to their community, it could impact how they vote on this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, can we do this? Can we vote on the amendment and then hold the bill, and then if the next time we convene, if people haven't come up with a substantive problem with it, then we can move the bill?
Okay. Sounds good. Are you guys all right?
That's really good, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate Representative Weirach. This is a, I think it's got a great chance for being a good vehicle for the state, and I think that Representative Hawker is right on target. What I would like to see that we do is that we rectify the situation. I don't think that it's ever good for a city to feel like they have to go ahead and go bankrupt because there's some kind of an inappropriate situation that's occurred like this. Thank you.
Representative Kelly?
I guess since Fairbanks is kind of the Biafran poster child here, we'll not only get back with you, but we'll do it today.
We will get
Jim and I were just talking about that, and we'll try to get a teleconference, and I think that it's a good idea to put this on the table, get this amendment passed so we have meat on the table that they can actually address it, so something that's in front of the body.
And Mr. Chairman, the other thing is I think the message has to be to these folks is this is the bill that's before us. We voted on the amendment. We're moving this baby unless you tell us some significant policy reason why we shouldn't. So the burden's on them. And otherwise, the legislature's done its job.
Okay, very good.
Representative Stoltz, do you remove your...
Remove my objection.
Okay, is there any other objection?
Mr. Chairman, I object for the purpose of looking at or listening to the testimony from the Fairbanks folks and whether they were advised to do something that absolutely was wrong, whether there were errors, omissions, things that the city of Fairbanks ought to be looking at independently, and I have no objection.
Okay, so you remove your objection.
Okay, so Amendment 2 will be adopted, and then we'll take this back up hopefully this afternoon. If not, tomorrow morning, however long it takes you to you folks get back to your colleagues in Fairbanks. And then if we need to adjust or revisit Amendment 2, we can at that time. So Amendment 2 is adopted, and for now we will set this aside. I want to welcome Representative Foster to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Bader. And Jacqueline again? Nope. Cool. Okay. Let's move on then to Senate Bill 250, Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Council. And let's see, Tom Mayer. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Maher. Okay, with Senator Terrio's office is going to tell us what this bill does.
Which is cool.
Let's see. Hold on just a second here. Yeah, we already adopted the CS, didn't we? No, we haven't. Is there CS?
Is this it?
Oh, okay. 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 We're working off the state affairs.
Doing amendments.
Yeah.
Okay, we need to catch up here.
I have to remember where we're at. Okay, so state affairs version, and if there's amendments, we'll work on it. Mr. Mayor, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Maher, staff to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, Senator Gene Terrio, chair. Also with us today, as usual on Sunsets, is Pat Davidson, the Legislative Auditor. On behalf of Senator Terrio and the LBNA Committee, we thank you again for hearing another Sunset audit. This is our final one that we will be bringing to your committee. So thanks for hearing Senate Bill 250, State Affairs, relating to the termination date of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Mr. Chairman, if appropriate, I'd like to quickly summarize the audit and also talk about the State Affairs version at the same time.
Go ahead.
I feel we probably didn't make a very good case at State Affairs just looking at their bill. In the Sunset Review, Legislative Audit concluded that the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault continues to serve a public need and is operating in the public interest. That's on page 7 of the Sunset Review. Accordingly, and per the auditor recommendation, Senate Bill 250 originally contained an 8-year extension from the Council from June 30th, 2006 to June 30th, 2014. I think it's important to know that this extension of 8 years was recommended even with the auditor noting that the Council had some outstanding audit issues concerning coordination with other agencies, which we'll talk about later. In absence of any other information, we still support the auditor's recommendation of an 8-year extension. The House State Affairs Committee version before you contains a 2-year extension. Chairman Terrio asked the House Finance Committee consider an expansion of this date to at least a 4-year extension. He strongly feels that now's the time to give the Council and the relatively new Executive Director a vote of confidence to go do their job. And having a full Sunset audit in just 2 years will serve to disrupt the Council activities and also impact our current schedule of audits pending. The audit on page 9 also addressed some ongoing operational concerns that include staff turnover and the failure of the council to address two statutory mandates regarding working with the Department of Education and Early Development and school districts on curricula for the cause, prevention, and treatment of domestic violence and sexual assault, and also coordinating with the Department of Health and Social Services on the delivery of services to victims of domestic violence by health care facilities and other providers. Mr. Chairman, I've seen your audit request, which is dated April 25th to the LBNA committee. That is requiring a 2008 update on these outstanding issues that were contained in the House State Affairs letter of intent. And it also incorporated another item, which is having the auditor review the council's strategic plan, including missions and measures. Chairman Terrio agrees that this audit is an appropriate tool to satisfy the concerns of the House State Affairs Committee and the legislature as a whole. And we respectfully request that the letter of intent not be adopted, since we now have the audit request moving forward. Also in the Sunset audit on page 11, the auditor recommended the legislature amend the council statutes, which are related to the appointment of council members. The council is comprised of 7 members, 3 public members appointed by the governor, and 4 statutory designated department heads or their designees. That's law, education, health and social services, and public safety. Current law requires the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Network, a nonprofit corporation, to submit a list of recommended candidates to the governor for appointment when a vacancy occurs. Further statutes require that the governor fill any unexpired term of a council member after consultation with the network. This language is passive in that the governor does not have to choose from the network list. The network annually receives a grant from the council for a legal advocacy project, and the appearance of conflict exists when a council member reviews, evaluates, approves, and monitors a grant to the same nonprofit organization that may have been responsible for recommending that individual be appointed to the council. Senate Bill 50 in its previous version contained language that removed both statutory references to the network. This language was deleted by the House State Affairs Committee, and Senator Terrio respectfully asks that the committee consider reinstatement of that language. Mr. Chairman, the legislative auditor can provide a little more detail on the conflict if the committee desires. Particularly in 2001, there were some reporting problems and other things that I think might be important to get on the record if you would like that. And she's here with us. Mr. Chairman, there are 2 fiscal notes, as you are aware. I think they have been corrected, and as you're aware, there is no impact to the budget since these amounts were included in the governor's operating budget and also have been incorporated in the House and Senate versions. And that's pretty much what I have, Mr. Chairman. I would appreciate if Pat could talk just a second about the conflict.
Yeah, we'd like to hear from Ms. Davidson. Thank you for your testimony. Welcome, Ms. Davis.
For the record, my name is Pat Davidson, representing the Division of Legislative Audit. As Tom indicated, we did do a sunset review last year and made 2 recommendations. One was that the council deal with the issues that are their statutory requirements, which is coordinating with the Department of Education and also with the Department of Health and Social Services in the areas that Tom mentioned. We also had a recommendation, which is repeated from the prior audit, and it had to do with elimination of the network from statute. The genesis of that recommendation came from the prior audit. And in that audit, what we had seen was grants that had gone to the network that had been modified. And they had been modified in ways that eliminated or severely restricted the council's primary job, which is the oversight of dispersion of funds. In FY01, the network modified its final grant that prohibited the council from reviewing all records. The FY00, they requested reimbursement but did not but did not provide supporting documentation. And in FY00 and FY01, the network was excluded from the monitoring schedule established by the council. When we saw those activities happening, we looked at the relationship between the network and the council and the council members, and that is the genesis of the recommendation. Again, the governor is certainly able to appoint anyone to the council. There are statutory requirements already in place to have certain commissioners to facilitate information between those departments of the council and from the council back to those departments. However, since it was not, and as a matter of fact, when we looked in the most recent audit, I think only two or three of the five most recent appointments came from the network's list. So it isn't anything that has consistently been done. We just thought it would be helpful to eliminate that possible appearance of a conflict of interest.
Okay, very good. Any questions for the sponsor or Ms. Davidson? Don't see any now. We may have some as we go through the public testimony here. Thank you very much. Okay, let us go on then to public testimony. I think we have some people online. Nancy Sheep, Frey Miller.
Good morning.
Good morning, Nancy.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Nancy Sheets Frey Miller, and I'm speaking as a previous public member of the council and also a previous executive director of the Abused Women's Program here in Anchorage. And I've been out of the council for a while, so I think I bring a perspective of kind of a looking from the outside in, and I'd like to speak for retaining the language on the network on domestic violence and sexual assault. And I guess where I'm coming from on this is to look at the long term. And I think we all want quality appointments because the quality appointments lead to the quality decision making. And to look at that, why the network was included in the first place, as kind of an insurance to this end for the long term. The network is an association of organizations in the communities. They work with all aspects of the communities in domestic violence and sexual assault. And they're kind of the people on the ground that know who currently can provide expertise and insight into these pervasive problems. And as you all know, the problem hasn't gone away. And I think now I really support the committee and hope that you will see the value of making the council more and more relevant, not less relevant. So I'd have to support the concept of having this network included as a statutory part of the recommendation process, because to me it only makes sense because the recommendations have always included people from various backgrounds. When I first came to AWAKE, a police chief was the chair of the council. So they may not be accepted, that as has been previously noted, but also I think that they provide a consistent input into bringing people to the governor that are currently in the communities and currently valuable to this issue. And so I would like to just say that I think it makes common sense to keep them in for the long term, and I thank you for this opportunity. And I'll take any questions.
Okay, thank you, Nancy. Any questions at this time? Thank you for your testimony. Let's go on now to Brenda Stanfill in Fairbanks.
Yes, my name is Brenda Stanfill, and I'm the current chair of the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and also the director of the Center for Nonviolent Living here in Fairbanks.
Those names are familiar from yesterday.
I wanted to speak to also the language being taken out of the network, giving information in terms of names, and remind everyone that the network is actually, while we have staff in Juneau, the network is actually those 21-member programs made up from around the state. I can't speak to what the auditor said earlier in terms of the perception of conflict, except to say that there are many agencies that are receiving those VAWA funds, so it's not like a straight grant. And I think it's been explained to, in my mind, very different than the grants I received from the council. What we're doing when we come forward with a list of names is we are looking in our community and we are seeing who's been active in the issue, who has knowledge. We're also looking for a well-rounded council. We want to make sure that there are representation from rural areas as well as urban, also from the diversity and cultures, and make sure that everyone's voice is represented there, the same as we do with our local boards in our own communities. So the network has been very good about saying, okay, we're meeting a rural person, you know, rural programs. Who do you have out there? Who's working in your program? Who do you know in your communities that would be willing to sit on these boards? And then that's the list of names that's going forward to the governor. We do realize that the governor doesn't have to use those names. We do put a lot of time and effort into getting together a list of names that would be good in working on this issue and addressing this issue in a statewide. We also know that once we recommend a person and that person is appointed to the council, that they then have an obligation to oversee just as all other council members, and it's not that now we have a friend on the council and that we can, you know, get additional grants or anything else. There's never been that perception, and I believe that all council members have taken their job very seriously. The public members who have been recommended by the network have never given any favors to anyone. I think it's a good process. I don't think it's broken. It's unfortunate that we're trying to fix something that's working. It's very challenging, from what I understand, for the governor's office to come up with names. We would continue to put forward names, but we would really ask that this language be kept in the bill that was coming out of State Affairs. And also, if you are going to remove the language of the network, to think about putting in some kind of language that would define who the public members are. Right now it's very generic. They can be anybody. So that means we could appoint 3 people from Juneau, and then you would have basically 7 people from Juneau sitting on the council and no representation from anywhere else. But some kind of definition is made of who those 3 public members are, whether they're rural, the kind of backgrounds they have, those kind of things. So thank you for your opportunity to speak to you today, and encourage you to keep the network in the language.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, Barbara. Brenda?
Any questions? Okay. Seeing none. Was there anyone else online? Okay. Is there anyone here in Juneau? Ma'am? Let's see. I do have Susan Parks, and are you Chris?
No, I'm Barbara Mason.
Barbara, okay. That's fine. You're on the list. Oh, yes, you're on. Sorry.
I'm the director.
Yeah, I missed you.
Okay, for the record.
My apologies.
It's okay. My name is Barbara Mason. I'm the executive director on the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to inform you about the council and the Sunset audit that we were just had completed. Our mission is to implement a statewide system of services for the protection of individuals and families affected by domestic violence and sexual assault. The council is comprised of 7 members consisting of representatives from 4 state agencies and 3 public members. Janice Stewart is our chair and a public member. Susan Parks is a vice chair and represents the Department of Law. Commissioner Bill Tandesky represents the Department of Safety. Barbara Thompson from the Department of Education and Early Development. Bill Hogan from the Department of Health and Social Services. Ann House is a public member and Kim Williams is a public member. I'm very lucky in this council. This is a very active council, which they are very knowledgeable, and they work very hard. They're concerned about this issue and are very involved. They are very responsive to my information, particularly since this is the first year and a half that I now have been here. They've been tremendous help in getting me on board and moving in the right direction. I've learned a great deal of working with them. At each quarterly meeting, the council reviews the reports that are given to us by the programs. And in those, there are given concerns, and all of our public and private or the state members will address those issues. So, for instance, if an issue is brought up around prosecution, Susan Parks takes those into account and follows up on them. So I would like to say that each of the members is very active, very involved, and very knowledgeable in terms of the domestic violence sexual assault issues. The legislative sunset audit is also a very thorough audit, which lasts for several months. Its purpose is to determine whether or not the council is serving the purpose for which it was intended. We were thoroughly reviewed over several years of our budget and our records. The council members and staff were interviewed. The programs we fund, their association, the network were interviewed. When all of the gathered information was analyzed, the recommendation was that the council overall is meeting its statutory requirements and is providing a public service and should continue. We are actively working on the legislative audit's recommendation around the issues of the Health and Social Services Department and the Department of Education. If you would like more specifics, I'd be more than happy to let you know what we are doing with that. If you have any questions, please let me know. I would like to finish off with saying that I agree with the legislative sunset audit that the council provides a much-needed public service and operates in the public interest, and we support extending our sunset audit date. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Barbara. Any questions? See none. Thank you very much. Okay. There's a Chris Ashenbrenner. Is that did you want to testify, or are you here for questions?
I'm at the network and available for questions.
Okay, very good, Chris. Thank you. I just want to make sure I wasn't missing anyone else. Is there anyone else here in Juneau who wants to testify? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. If we could have both Tom and Barbara come back up, please. And let's go ahead and take amendments. First Amendment is Amendment 1, and I'll go ahead and move Amendment 1.
I'll have a meaningful objection.
Okay. Amendment 1 is being moved. Again, we're working off the State Affairs Committee bill, and they had recommended a sunset of 2008. This would make it 2010. And the reason I'm doing this was that it seems like you need that additional time to do an audit and also give the council time to implement the suggestions that we're recommending. I'd like to get your input on this amendment.
The audit request that you have on those selected issues, that will be reported back to the legislature in 2008. The 2010 date makes sense to us, giving a little more time. So we support the amendment.
It makes sense. All right, that's good. Thanks.
We prefer 8 years, but we support your amendment.
Okay. Did you have anything?
Just for members' attention, besides legislative audit going in there under sunset audits, to the extent they have federal funds going in, we may also be in during our statewide federal compliance review. In prior years, those funds have been looked at under that. Additionally, the council may go through federal reviews. And when we made the recommendation for an eight-year extension, it was with that understanding that besides the sunset review that they get, that provides feedback to the legislature and to the public about their operations, there are other audit processes going on because they're a state agency. And I just thought that I would bring that to the members' attention when they're grappling with how far out do they want to go. Do they want to go out 4 years, 8 years? They are an audited entity.
Okay, very good. Representative Barber.
Question. I don't see the original Senate bill in the file. So what was the original sunset date in the original bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wyrek, it was for 8 years to 2014, June 30th.
Okay, and that got changed in House State Affairs. To
That's correct. Okay.
And then,
go ahead,
Mr. Chairman, there was a committee substitute in the file. We're not going off that.
No, we're working off the State Affairs, and then we'll just amend the State Affairs version.
Mr. Chairman, if the House State Affairs Chairman doesn't mind us amending this bill, I'll remove my objection.
Okay. If there's no other objection, then Amendment 1 will be adopted. Okay, Amendment 2, I'll move. Okay.
Sure.
And I'm going to let the sponsor speak to Amendment 2. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, we appreciate you bringing this forward again. We've heard the testimony. I guess I'd say that to go off my notes a bit, you know, the network has done a great job. They are the people that really started an organized effort in dealing with domestic violence and sexual assault in this state. By no means are we trying to lessen the importance of the network. The committee issued this recommendation. We feel like we presented a case on it and talked about when it was a problem. I think that if people think the network's important, they might want to vote yes on this amendment, because this will obviously prevent anything, conflict, or even the appearance of occurring in the future. So we do support the amendment.
Okay. Any other comments, questions on Amendment 2? Okay. I think you objected.
I objected to it. And I'll remove it.
And, there's no other objection to Amendment 2. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, you want to object for purpose of discussion?
Yeah,
may I? Yes. Go ahead, Mr. Mark.
So, the term of office is two years, and they serve at the pleasure of the governor without two consecutive terms, and the governor appoints new vacancies. What are the term of offices of a member now?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps Pat might be able to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe it is in the report, but let me just check. And the question is, what is the...
Yeah, I mean, why have that second part? What's the substitute policy using for change amending that?
I believe Section B,
go ahead.
If I may,
mm-hmm. Sure.
It's in there because that's the other part that requires or that has the governor consulting with the network on domestic violence. And so not only is the network not going to have to make recommendations to the governor will not have to consult with the network. Those would be the two sections of the bill. I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
Go ahead.
Well, the question is to the amendment. And the amendment deals with terms of office. And that didn't, I had a disconnect between what the amendment and what you just said. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, the way I understand this, we are not changing any term of office. We're just merely deleting the two statutory references.
Just the after the consultation portion.
Well, we'll come back to you, Representative Mark, if you have additional questions. Representative Stoltz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure your intent. As I read this, this doesn't I think there's still the advisory role. It's just not written down in the statute that they're going to submit the names that he may or may not even consider. I can't imagine the network not continuing to have a role. I've had the privilege of having the public safety budget for the last 4 years, and I've always invited them in, and I would suspect that because I want to hear what their opinions are on the budget and the CDVSA and many other parts of the public safety budget. Is that your intent and the sponsor's intent to remove some cumbersome
language? Mr. Chairman, we believe that will still occur.
I just can't imagine. They're certainly one of the more activist groups. They are the most loyal attendees of our budget process, and I just can't imagine they're not going to be involved in letting their feelings known in transition of a new administration and all the way down to, I don't think you're going to keep down some strong advocates like that, no matter what you write in this bill and its advisory language.
Yeah. I guess the only problem I have with this amendment is that it removes the interaction between the council and the governor. And I always think it's good to get input. It doesn't bind the governor to do anything, but it just requires the input. So I'll just maintain the objection.
Okay. Yeah, it's my understanding the network still is allowed to provide recommendations to the governor. It's not going to prohibit that.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Any other questions, comments? Okay. So, Representative Warwick, you still object to the amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Secretary.
Representative Kelly.
Yes.
Representative Holmes?
No.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes.
Representative Weirach?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Holm?
No.
Representative Jewell?
No.
Representative Meyer?
Yes.
4-4.
Okay, Amendment 2
fails. Okay, we'll go on now to, actually, this Amendment 3 was Representative Catullo's conceptual amendment. I think, Representative Jewell, is it okay if we allow Representative Catullo to bring this up on the floor? Or would you like to move it?
I haven't talked to her about it, so I'll just assume
it. She didn't mention it, so okay. Yeah, she was concerned about the Hatcher Pass, but... so let's just go ahead and not take up Amendment 3 at this time. Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman.
All right, Amendment 3 was only needed if Amendment 2 passed, so we don't need Amendment 3.
And I'd be interested in talking, I assume that the Budget Audit Committee was the primary sponsor of Amendment number 2 through the chair, mm-hmm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk with me more about really what's going on here, we can talk, that's subject to change on the floor.
Gotcha. Okay, is there any other discussion on the bill, Senate Bill 250? Let's see, there is the, I think everybody got a copy of the letter requesting the audit. And the fiscal notes, public safety and fiscal notes. Is there anything else that we need to...
Is the letter of intent part of the...
No, I don't think it's part of the...
Okay.
No, the letter of intent is not part of the bill. Okay. So, is there anything else come? Any other discussion? If not, I think we're ready to move this with the attached fiscal notes for acceptance as amended.
Okay, I'll go ahead and move SB 250 out of the Finance Committee as amended with individual recommendations with the attached fiscal notes.
Bill 250 passes committee. Ms. Davis. All right, let's go ahead and get started on Senate Bill 237. This is the additional judges for the 3rd District. I guess I'll ask Ms. Parks and Mr. Christensen to introduce this bill and why it's needed, why it's necessary. We wouldn't pass so many laws, we wouldn't meet so many judges, right?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Susan Parks. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division Department of Law.
I'm Chris Christensen. I'm the Deputy Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System.
It's a pleasure to be here to speak in support of this bill and talk about sort of what prompted it. The Attorney General likes to take credit for getting this started. I think that what got the administration interested in adding judges was the Attorney General was talking with various district attorneys around the state and was concerned at hearing how long it was taking to get cases to trial, particularly serious cases. In Anchorage, a homicide case typically takes 2 or 3 years to get to trial, and there was a strong feeling amongst the district attorneys that a lot of the problem was that we did not have adequate judicial resources available to get cases to trial. And after speaking with the DAs, the Attorney General met with the Department of Administration, with the Governor's Office, with the court system, and we all agree that instead of doing what we often do in the criminal justice system of pointing fingers, that we really wanted to work together to try to give the system what it needed to work efficiently and adequately, and came up with the original bill, which proposed 4 Superior Court judges around the state. The bill you have before you, SB 237, actually would add 6 judges to Superior Court, 2 in Anchorage, 2 in Palmer, 1 in Kenai, and 1 in Fairbanks. And just to talk about why we think this is needed, to give you a little bit about the numbers, felony referrals around the state are up 64% in the last 10 years. And as I'm sure you can well imagine, we have not increased our judicial resources 64% in the last 10 years. So the caseloads are up, but there's more to it than that. We've also increased prosecutors. We've increased police resources, so more people are being arrested. More cases are being processed. We have created more crimes. This legislature has created more crimes, such as felony DUI. DUIs have come into being, so there are more felony cases to be prosecuted. Cases have become more complex. It used to be a typical drug case was perhaps possession of cocaine. Now we're dealing with meth lab cases. We're dealing with DNA evidence in cases, not just homicide cases and rape cases, but we even solve burglary cases nowadays using DNA. So not only do we have more cases to deal with, but there's more scientific evidence, more expert witnesses, more motion work to deal with. So the litigation in these cases is becoming more complex, creating more work for the attorneys, more work for the judges, taking up more court time. Victims' rights have impacted cases in a good way, I believe, but I think if we didn't recognize that it also can slow down the system, take up more resources, we wouldn't be looking at another factor. Victims need to be involved in the system. Victims need to have a voice at sentencing, a voice at hearings, and that has taken up additional time in processing cases. So I think all these factors have created a situation where our system is not working efficiently. We are not serving the public or justice the way we should, and these new judges are needed in order to do that. Just briefly to talk about a couple of other things, I just wanted to let the committee know Palmer is our number one priority, and I think Mr. Christensen can probably talk about the numbers and where Palmer falls in the caseloads, but due to a lot of factors, not the least of which is sort of the population explosion in the Palmer-Matsu area, they've seen an explosion of crime. Their caseloads went from 2002, we had 595 felony referrals. It went up by 200 in the year 2005, we had 869 referrals. So the cases, again, have just exploded. The Palmer court is so overloaded, they only currently have two Superior Court judges. They're doing night court just to handle the volume of cases that they have there because they can't handle them during the daytime with the judges they have. Again, Anchorage, the cases, we have a trailing calendar. We currently have 28 murder trials pending trial in Anchorage, 19 of which are over a year old. That's the kind of backlog you have, and as you know, if judges aren't there available to do trials, cases don't settle, cases don't get resolved. Kenai is another incredibly growing area. Just Department of Law alone, we went from 2 years ago, four prosecutors, to this year we're going to end up having seven prosecutors to handle the caseload down on the Kenai Peninsula. And finally, Fairbanks has unfortunately seen an increase in crime as well. In 2002, we had 820 felony referrals. By 2005, we were up to 1,088. So again, those numbers just keep going up. So I would urge you to support this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about what prompted the bill or anything about the Department of Law fiscal notes. I believe that there are other department representatives here available to talk about their fiscal notes, and Mr. Christensen will address the court systems.
We do have a question, Representative Holm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In our analysis here, it looks as if the amount of money that you're raising the judges is 50% increase this year. It goes from 9,200 to 13,000 per month.
I'm going to defer to Mr. Christensen on that.
Oh, actually, did you want to make some comments first, and then we'll just take questions for both of you? That might be the best thing. Mr. Christensen, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just a couple of observations in addition to what Ms. Park said, and that is, you know, you've heard almost every year for the last 10 years, you've seen in the news the FBI says the crime rate is down, and you have to wonder, how are we getting all this work?
And I think the simple answer is we have more police officers in Alaska than we used to. Anchorage, for example, has added almost 40 new police officers in the last 5 years alone. More police officers means more felonies are actually solved. So while there may be fewer felonies, more perpetrators are being caught and brought to justice. And that's good news, but it's also bad news. You know, in the past, we have always been very, very frugal in our request for new judges, and I think that has finally caused enough harm to the Department of Law and others that that they felt the need to come forward with this. You may remember about 10 years back, we needed a new Superior Court judge in Palmer, and instead of coming to you and asking you to fund it, we simply transferred a Superior Court judge in Valdez to Palmer because the Valdez caseload had gone down, and we thought they didn't need a Superior Court judge anymore. They're still angry about that decision. I hear about it every year. So we have attempted to be frugal, and quite frankly, I think that has caught up with us. We have fallen far, far behind, and we do need to catch up. Mr. Chairman, I know time is short. You have to go to the floor. So maybe perhaps I will address the issue of the pay raise, since it did come up.
Okay.
The other aspect of this bill is the judicial pay raise. Judges occupy sort of a unique niche among state employees. They're full-time employees who are hired to do a specific job, like most employees. At the same time, they're appointed to office like commissioners, and they stand in regularly scheduled elections like legislators. And it's sort of these unique combination of features that has caused some issues over the years with how the legislature has chosen to fund their salaries. From statehood up until about 1990, the legislature tied our judges' salaries roughly to the salary of the federal bench, because the federal judges in Alaska do the same work that our state judges do, and they're drawn from the same pool of applicants. Since 1990, our judges have dropped approximately 42% in salary relative to the federal judiciary. Even a federal magistrate today, which is basically a misdemeanor judge, is being paid 20% more than we pay our Supreme Court justices, and about 30% more than we pay our Superior Court judges. This relative decline in our judicial salaries is not just limited to a comparison with the federal bench. The National Center for State Courts keeps a list of what judges make, adjusted for cost of living. There are 48 states that keep cost of living data. And in the early 1980s, our judges were number one in the country. Today, they're number 47 of 48, once adjusted, their salaries are adjusted for cost of living. As you know, commissioners have been in the same boat as judges. They have not received pay raises. Last year, you decided to give them a 37% pay raise. It used to be, at the time of statehood, commissioners were paid about 30% less than a judge. Today, Superior Court judges make substantially less than a commissioner.
Chris, I don't mean to interrupt, but I think what I'd like to do is I have two people who want to testify, so let's go ahead and take them so they don't have to come back this afternoon. And then if you guys would come back this afternoon at 1:30, we can get into more detail on the salary and the fiscal notes. We'll take you up right before PPT. We'll need the PPT to pay for the judges, it sounds like. So why don't we go ahead and do the public testimony, and then we can close that, and those folks won't have to hang around for this afternoon. I show Josh Fink and Clinton Steiner. Is that correct? Josh, are you still with us?
Mr. Chairman, this is Josh Fink with OPA.
Josh, go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I was making myself available for questions on the fiscal note. I didn't have testimony of the bill. I mean, OPA obviously supports the bill, and I would associate my comments with Susan Parks.
All right. Then we may need you back this afternoon then, Josh, because we're going to deal with fiscal notes at 1:30.
I will be back.
Okay. Is that the same with Quinlan?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Was there anyone who wanted to testify? Is there anyone else online? Okay. Anyone here in the audience? Okay, well, let's go ahead and close public testimony and then bring this bill back up and get into more detail on the fiscal notes, and I'm sure there'll be more questions, and hopefully we can get through that fairly quickly, and then we can get into the PPT. All right, we're adjourned until 1:30 this afternoon. Thanks.
Hey, Chris. Could you get sections 4, 6, chapter 53, SOA 2005?
I guess you can see
what
I'm
talking about. From the.
Well, and then we got the.
Yeah, isn't that something? Can you imagine that?
I
suppose it's private attorneys that make a hell of a lot of
money. But has there been an exodus from the Supreme Court for economic reasons? Great retirement. And anyway, it's like talking about, yeah, they have to stand retention every 10 years. They get to make more laws than we ever do.
Yeah.
You're right, they do.
That's the problem.
Judges, you think judges have to be elected? You know, I'd like some little hybrid. I'd like this.
He's got a lot of it.
Judicial council, where it's the lawyers pretty much run the show.
Yeah, I know. They hired him.
Oh, yes.
Hey,
yeah.
Talk to
him.
Oh,
okay.
Then we
kept
that together.
Okay.
Kelly, I was trying to help out my Fairbanks Senate friend, and your guy went south on us.
On what?
On that amendment, too.
Oh. I don't know what happened.
Whole voted against Turnbull's amendment.
Well, and I got to confess, I tried to burrow into that thing, and I spent 45 minutes on that with my staff, and it was like, I wasn't getting